Coming up next is Circle A, and the topic tonight is the movement for democracy in Nepal.
State of emergency has been used to clamp down on rivals. The concern is no one's representing the Nepalese people. Student leaders and politicians are under arrest. Today, the new government imposed a six-month ban on the local media. No anti-monarch stories.
Protests, which began earlier this month, continue in Nepal.
In Nepal, hundreds of thousands of people have filled the streets of Kathmandu to celebrate King Ganendra's decision to reinstate the country's parliament. The king's announcement came after weeks of protests and strikes that have crippled Nepal. Last night, the king announced he would agree to some of the demands of the protesters.
And you coming from America, I feel really sad, you know, that when you hear the word communist, you see someone as really war ravagers and, you know, someone who's, you know, sucking the blood and all that. Let's come down to the basic word communist. What is communist? It's something to do with the community. You become a full person only when the whole society becomes fully blown and is in a position to eat and think freely. You don't become individually free when you have maximum number of people tied down by poverty, tied down by not having access to democracy.
There's a lot of discrimination existing in our present society. She actually joined the People's Liberation Army because in order to liberate women, to fight for equal rights.
Being sensitive to women's issue is actually to be sensitive towards the poor people, towards the oppressed ethnic groups, towards the oppressed religious groups. So it is a mother of all the oppression. If you address that correctly, you actually address not only your society's problem, not only your country's problem, but the world's.
Major changes are underway in Nepal. In the second major pro-democracy movement since 1990, people from all over the country, including members of an alliance of seven popular political parties, Maoist insurgents, students, and trade unionists, joined together in massive protests forcing the king to relinquish power and reinstate parliament.
It was not much more than a year ago, February 1st, 2005, when the king declared a state of emergency and took absolute power. Since the reinstatement of their House of Representatives in May, Nepal has been declared a secular state. 33% of government seats at all levels are reserved for women, and untouchability has been outlawed.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we hear personal experiences from Sage Radichowski and David Bloomer, who have spent time working with civil society organizations in Nepal.
This is an interview with Sage Radichowski, who was in Nepal at the time of the king's coup. This interview is courtesy of Boston Indie Media.
To Sage Radichowski, an ally to the struggle for democracy and basic liberties in Nepal. He was there in Nepal on February 1st when the king took over. What organizations are you affiliated with?
I work sometimes with International Nepal Solidarity Network and sometimes with Peace Brigades International.
And so you've actually been in Nepal?
Yes, I've been there seven times now. The last time I was there, I left February 2nd, the day after the royal coup.
My impression from being an activist in Boston is that there are very few people who have heard practically anything about this coup. At least that's my experience. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what happened and why you think it's been so underreported.
Yeah, I mean, it was an intense experience. I woke up that morning on February 1st at 8 a.m. and got a call from a friend who said something's going to happen at 10 o'clock. The king's going to be talking on TV. So I was supposed to have a meeting in an embassy that day. So I was at the embassy and we all gathered around the TV at 10 and watched the king. as he said, basically, in the name of democracy, in the name of the free press, and protection of basic rights, I have to take over. And then he proceeded to dismantle all of those basic rights. And while he was on TV, all of the phones, the mobiles, the internet, all communications were shut off, and the army was simultaneously occupying all of the media houses, every newspaper office, every TV and radio station in the country. And at the same time, all of the old government officials, the top ministers, and the leaders of all the parties, even the parties that weren't in the government at the time, were under house arrest or detained and arrested wherever they were and put into jail. Hmm. And the phones, all the communications remained shut off for 5 days, so the only way you could communicate with the outside world was to have a satellite phone, which basically only embassies have, so people were... Just a few people were able to have any access to communications with the outside world.
So were people kidnapped during that time and so-called disappeared for political reasons?
Well, Nepal basically leads the world in the number of disappearances, but that was already the case before February 1st. So in terms of what happened on February 1st and after, there were massive numbers of arrests, about 600 arrests that we know about, among political party activists, human rights activists, other kinds of activists, journalists, trade unionists, and reporters. The whole crowd, anybody who would basically be critical of the takeover, was arrested. But in terms of disappearances, I mean, I think disappearances take a while to come out as well, because people have to report it and it has to go through a filtering system. So we don't know if there are actually any disappearances at this time after the 1st of February. But, I mean, there still remain around 1,000 people disappeared in Nepal from before that day. And, you know, their families are still waiting to hear, find out where they are.
So this recent coup is part of an ongoing civil war in Nepal between Maoists and the king. In general terms, how would you characterize the difference between the Maoists and the king on a political level?
Well, the Maoists want to take over the state and establish a communist republic. Basically, I mean, that's their ultimate goal, and they may settle for some other outcome, perhaps. I mean, that's a matter of speculation, whether they'd settle for having a constituent assembly that would draft a Republican constitution, but would remain a multi-party democratic system. And the king is also a matter of speculation. I mean, he says that he supports multi-party democracy, and he wants to maintain the system that had been instituted in 1990 with the Movement for Restoration of Democracy, where Nepal moved from being a basically one-party royalist system into a multi-party democracy with a parliament and prime minister and everything. But, I mean, what the king has been showing in the recent years, and he attributes it to the conflict, saying basically, I have to take more power to solve this conflict and then return to multi-party democracy. But what he's been showing is basically a tendency toward dictatorship, toward an autocratic system, toward basically a monarchy without even structures of democracy.
Mm-hmm. To some extent, people who are supporting the Maoists see themselves as fighting racism in Nepal. Would you say that?
Yes, I mean, in terms of racism, in Nepal, this plays out in terms of caste discrimination and also ethnic group discrimination. So these two kinds of racism going on. And the Maoist movement actually gains a lot of strength by being very vocally against caste discrimination. And then a lot of members from the so-called lower castes join the Maoists, because here are some people coming and treating them as human beings, apparently, you know, and also giving them training, giving them a gun, giving them power of some kind where they've had no power for so long. I mean, so people in the U.S. who think a lot about racism can understand that kind of a parallel in Nepal and throughout South Asia, throughout at least a lot of South Asia, the caste discrimination element. Although I'm not a Maoist supporter and I'm against their violence and their means of working, I have met Maoists on several occasions in Nepal, and I've been to various degrees impressed or non-impressed. But, I mean, basically everybody agrees with most of their basic demands and most of their positions in terms of their critiques of the current situation. I mean, critiquing the horrible caste discrimination and economic inequality and gender discrimination and, you know, all of the other things that are problems in Nepal. I mean, most people agree with that statement, and it's just the means that they're going about addressing these that a lot of people don't support.
Okay. So part of your job over there in Nepal was to monitor human rights abuses?
That's a small part of my job. I mean, to keep a basic eye on the situation and to understand what the situation is. I mean, I've been working with Peace Brigades International to try to set up some kind of program to support civil society in Nepal, basically activists and journalists and trade unionists and the human rights people who are trying to document what's happening out in the countryside.
Can you talk a little bit about what is happening out in the countryside and how that relates to the King's coup?
The people in the countryside are basically the ones most caught in the civil war. I mean, they're caught in between the Maoists and the government. People in the cities basically have the security of not being harassed by the Maoists, at least not as often. I mean, the Maoists have done a couple of targeted assassinations in cities, but they basically don't have much reach there. But people in the countryside are caught between the two powers. I mean, when Maoists come into their village, they have to appear to agree with the Maoists, and they have to provide them some food or whatever they ask for, sometimes payment, depending on how wealthy the particular villager is. And when the army comes, the army will ask people, you know, have you seen the Maoists? Where did they go? And try to basically they'll accuse some people of being Maoist sympathizers. And, you know, both sides have killed ordinary villagers who were not belonging to the other side or informing for the other side just because they kind of get caught in the middle. I went to Nepal for the first time 10 years ago, and what I found was, compared to my life in the United States, I found a remarkably open society where people are willing to talk about anything. And they would, you know, they would state their beliefs and they would stand by them. And they, you know, they would discuss their beliefs with people very openly. And through the years, especially the last 3 years, when the conflict started to escalate dramatically, it's just become silent in the hills. People, they talk about the weather, they talk about the crops, but they don't talk about political beliefs, and they don't talk about what they think about either side in the conflict. They don't talk about the government so much or the Maoists. So basically people are trying to remain silent and try to remain neutral, even if they have beliefs. And most of them actually, I mean, they resent both sides because both sides are causing them to have to be silent and live in fear just to survive. And so the space for discussing, the political space, has just shrunk to nothing, and people are just trying to live from day to day without getting caught in the violence.
Can you talk about anyone who you have known personally who has been caught in the violence?
Well, I had some students who I taught about 8 years ago in a village in western Nepal, and two of my former students have died now. They had joined the Maoists, and they were killed in a battle in a town called Gum. And so basically in the next village over, there's a little monument with some red flags, and they become, you know, martyrs of the Maoist movement, basically. I've also gotten to know a few people who have been placed under house arrest or are being chased right now by the police, basically going from house to house and living underground and sending out emails every few days about their situation and their beliefs about Nepal. I mean, they're still being politically active and they're being persecuted for it. And their beliefs are nothing militant or violent, but basically, you know, saying we need to return to civil liberties and we need a more open democracy in Nepal. I know this bookseller who was arrested and disappeared for 2 months because among his many books about how to make more money, how to, you know, psychology and different cookbooks and other things, he also had a few books by Mao and some by Lenin. And this was just basically in his, you know, street bookselling business. He just had a blanket with a bunch of books on it of all different topics, and he was disappeared for 2 months and 2 days. And his family, he had a small baby and his wife didn't know where he was for 2 months. And he was basically kept in an army barracks with a black hood over his head, and he was threatened that they were going to kill him if he didn't tell them who's supporting him, where he got those books, etc. And this kind of thing happens far too much. I mean, people are just arrested, and there doesn't have to be any justification. And then they're just sometimes released, sometimes not released. And oftentimes there are no formal charges. People are just released with no papers after being held incommunicado for months and months. And I also have gotten to know this woman who, about 1 year ago, her daughter was taken by the army or the police. And she lived in Cabre District, which is about 40 kilometers northeast of Kathmandu. One night she was over visiting at her sister's house, I believe, and the army came and knocked on the door. Basically, they ended up taking this woman's daughter and her niece, and allegedly for 5 hours the army was raping this woman's niece. And then they later found her body with, you know, some of the clothes partially removed and basically several bullet wounds. And this woman the next day went to the chief district officer to try to locate her own daughter, and she went there with about 20 something of the villagers as backup and safety for her. And they said, "We don't have her," basically. So anyway, for 11 months she had been trying to find her daughter, and finally when the High Commissioner for Human Rights with the UN system was on a visit to Nepal in the end of January this year, in front of her and the US ambassador and the senior advisor for human rights with the UN, there was a brief program where this woman met the chief of army staff, and basically he said, "I'm sorry, we made a mistake, and your daughter is dead." So after 11 months of not knowing where her daughter was and holding out hope to find her, she finally learned that she was indeed dead. And the army said it was sorry for a mistake, basically.
Can you talk about what the United States government's reaction has been to the situation in Nepal?
Well, the reaction of the administration was fairly good and fairly swift in making a statement that we need to see a return to at least a democratic system and the basic civil liberties, and that this move by the king was counterproductive in any case in the conflict, and that it would, if anything, it would help the Maoists. But then since that time we've seen sort of a backsliding by the US. On the 2nd of March, a State Department official in a briefing in Washington outlined kind of a slightly different position, where he compared the potential governance of the Maoists to the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And basically, the position was that, yes, we want to see civil liberties restored in Nepal, and we want to see democracy there, but the potential human rights abuses that might happen if the Maoists took over are so great that basically some things can be justified in the present, some violations by the current government. And so I see this as kind of a return to a Cold War mentality. And I don't believe that justifications can be made. Nothing can justify violations in the present, even if the potential future is bad. But that's the administration's position.
One other question I'm curious about is, aside from spreading information about what's going on and just informing each other, what can people in the United States do? How can we be allies to the people in Nepal?
I mean, the U.S. has kind of a strong position in relation to Nepal in terms of foreign policy, as it does with most nations in the world, just by being such a dominant nation. So by being U.S. citizens, there's that kind of inherent position of power that people have. And so if you feel you have any effect on senators and representatives, then having your voice be heard, and every check mark or tally that somebody has called up and is concerned about Nepal may make a difference, because there are so few people actually doing it. So basically, to get it on the radar screen of senators and representatives is very important. And you can also work on the State Department. You can work on the administration. You can just be another person who has called up. Maybe there have been one dozen people, you know, or 25 or 50, but you can be one more. Because it's not an issue like Iraq, where that's like dominating the public consciousness. And the government knows it, and they know they need to be very careful with the issue. So the more people that show that they're watching what the U.S. is doing in Nepal, the better. And then there's the whole different ways that people can work outside of government. I mean, totally ignoring the realm of government and that mode of working. People can make connections with other people in Nepal. You can search on different websites about Nepal, and you can find different civil society groups working on all kinds of issues, from caste discrimination, gender discrimination, and media issues. Groups of lawyers and human rights activists who are trying to bring cases in civil courts, and now completely failing, of course, because the civil courts are owned by the king. And all kinds of different groups, and you can kind of research what different groups are doing, which is really amazing to me all the time. I'm completely amazed by the number and the vibrancy of the groups in Nepal and what they're doing outside of the government, I mean the civil society. And if you feel really inspired, you can go to Nepal and you can observe the situation firsthand. You can go, and for $30 US, you can buy a visa in the airport, go on a tourist visa for 30 days or 60 days, and just hang around, talk with people, and see what's going on. And I guess if you have any special skills or have a professional background in law or journalism, media, or anything like this, I mean, there is great opportunity to put that to use to internationalize the issues in Nepal.
For daily news about the aftermath of the royal coup in Nepal, visit the International Nepal Solidarity Network website at www.insn.org.
Thanks to Boston Indie Media for that interview with Sage Radichowski. He works with international non-governmental organizations and grassroots community groups. Last week, he spoke with us about the culture and political climate of Nepal.
My name is David Bloomer. My organization in Nepal, the name is Asaman Nepal. It means blue sky. And their work is primarily in the field of child labor reduction programs. Almost all programs in Nepal have some sort of awareness-raising component. It's not quite as easy as this child is working and needs to be in school, and you go and get them, and then you put them in school. A lot of it is just that, particularly if you work with lower caste communities, which was what I did primarily work with, it seems to be an inevitability that people believe that if you're a lower caste girl, especially, that you're only going to go to school, if you go to school at all, for maybe 1 or 2 years, and then they're going to arrange your marriage and you'll be married by 12. So a lot of this was just changing people's perceptions about, you know, this is a cycle that's been going on for hundreds of years with your family, and the way to break out of this is that you need to send your children to school as a sort of first step and give them access, give them opportunities. That was a lot of my work, was just working directly with communities trying to change perceptions about children and working, and if they're lower caste or if they're girls. The organization I worked for, primarily Asaman Nepal, they linked the child labor with access to schools, access to education. So we tried to work with district education offices, because all of these child labor laws are on the books. No one's enforcing them. Because of the Maoist situation in the country, district level government is really non-functional, dysfunctional. No one goes to work. They're threatened by Maoists if they do. Most of the district education offices and other district level government would be closed most of the time. So it was quite a challenge. In a nutshell, it was sort of a push-pull kind of strategy, where we're continually pushing on district level agencies to be more accountable and transparent and to do the things that they were supposed to do. At the same time, the kind of pool with the local communities and getting children out of work, particularly the hazardous sorts of occupations, making bricks, carpet factories, these types of things. It's probably 75% girls. There are essentially four caste in Nepal, with Brahmins at the top, Kshatriyas the second. In the middle is a sort of a hodgepodge, a mixture of ethnic groups. Muslims can also be in there. Even a foreigner like myself would be sort of lumped in this middle caste. Below that is the Dalits. They don't use the term untouchable anymore. Dalit means essentially those who are oppressed. You're born into your caste. There's no way out of your caste. Most people, from Brahmins all the way down to Dalits, will marry within their caste. If they marry outside of their caste, they have difficulties. Their families will disown them for the most part. There's some intercaste marriage going on. It tends to be more the upper caste, where it's a little more acceptable. But for a Brahmin man, let's say, the top caste, to marry a Dalit woman would be, it's almost unheard of.
Is there any kind of cultural competition between the idea of education and the idea of being locked in a caste system, being that education is this opportunity for self-enhancement,
mm-hmm.
but if you're born into your caste, mm-hmm. there's really no opportunity
mm-hmm.
to enhance your position?
You're right when you talk about access. It's all about access to things. The caste system itself, for the most part, directly translates into a class system. It does have less to do with economics, and I think it's primarily is because you're born into it. But not necessarily if you're a Brahmin are you going to be wealthy, but you're going to have access to everything. Yeah, you have those opportunities. I think both Brahmins, Kshatriyas, the second and the third caste, for the most part, have access. It's really the splinter between the very top three and then the bottom, with Dalits, who have really no access to anything. I mean, they don't even have access to running water. They're completely segregated in separate villages, at least in the rural areas they are. In Kathmandu, it's a bit more integrated. Outside of Kathmandu, you generally have a sense of who's Dalit and who's not Dalit. They know by family name. If you know the family name, then you will know immediately who's Dalit and who's Brahmin and who's everyone else. Outside of Kathmandu, Dalits tend to do manual labor, so they're out in the sun. Complexion tends to be darker. Little signals like that. I myself would have a hard time identifying. Nepalis tend to know. It's very difficult for me, as someone outside of the caste system, to talk to Nepalis about the caste, because it will generally come back and say, well, you don't understand. You're not a Hindu. You weren't born into this system, and so you really, really don't understand. We have laws protecting everyone. Yeah, Dalits have access to education. They have access to health care, etc. This is the sort of rhetoric that you hear.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. Tonight we are exploring current events in Nepal through the eyes of Western aid workers. Again, David Bloomer.
There are hundreds of Dalit groups. I support the Dalit groups and I've worked with lots of them, but even within the caste system, there's a sub-caste system. And Dalits will organize themselves according to their sub-caste. If you're at the bottom, if you're the caste that drags dead animal carcasses outside of town, that's what you're born into. And the top, even the top Dalit caste, they tend to be goldsmiths, silversmiths, artisans. They will discriminate against the lower caste Dalits. It's an amazingly complicated and difficult system. One of the things that I've been doing with my organization and working with some other Dalit organizations is to try to bring the Dalit movement together. they've done a lot of good work over the past 15 years. You also have to understand that in Nepal there really were no NGOs, there really were no civil society groups until about 15 years ago from the original, the first Jana Andolan, as they call it in Nepal, the first people's movement in 1990. Within that short period, I think they've done remarkable things, but at the same time, we're trying to bring a lot of the splinter Dalit groups together to work more collaboratively. There are probably equally as many women's groups as there are Dalit groups, and these are the two main sort of areas within the NGO development community, groups that are working for issues for women, and then also at the caste-based groups tend to be more with the Dalits. With women, it's also a matter of access, I think. If you're in a municipality, if you're in Kathmandu, if you're not from the lowest caste, then probably you have access to basic education, and probably through high school as well. But there's still a real expectancy that once you're married, you become part of your husband's family. You're sort of given away. And then you're kind of at their mercy. It's still expected that women will stay at home, will have children, will do that work. This idea that when you're married, you become part of your husband's family. If your husband should die before you, traditionally widows would be sent away to an ashram, or if they're lucky, to an ashram. Maybe they would just be sent away to live on the streets. They're never to remarry. There's a huge untouchability issue with widows. They're not supposed to touch married women. Their shadows are not supposed to overcast other women. If you're a young girl who's been married off by your family, and your husband maybe dies when you're 12 years old, your life, you're not supposed to do anything for the rest of your life. You're supposed to sort of pray for your dead husband and also for your favorable rebirth. The next slide.
A couple days ago, while you were in Portland, the papers report there were 200,000 people rallying in Kathmandu. Can you tell us about the political circumstances in Nepal and kind of what has led up to this recent massive demonstration?
Yeah, that recent movement was a Maoist rally. I'm not exactly sure how many years it's been, but it's the first time that the Maoists have been allowed to come into Kathmandu to hold a massive rally. The people's movement in March and April, before the massive rallies on the streets, there was a 12-point agreement between the seven political parties and the Maoist that there would be a ceasefire, that they would support their movement on the streets. They had the common goal was to force the king to step down and to reinstate parliament and to also call elections. My understanding is that held during about a two-month period. Since then, I know that there have been some talks. They're trying to get the Maoists to agree to a permanent ceasefire, to lay down their weapons and to come and be part of the free elections. I hope that will happen. The biggest issue with the Maoists, I believe, is that it's very difficult to know who's in charge, who's controlling the different regions of Nepal. You hear of atrocities on both sides, from the Nepali security forces and also from the Maoists. But from the Maoist side, they tend to be kind of splinter groups. Most of the time, Prachanda or someone within the top leadership of the Maoists will deny that they had any involvement in that. There's a lot of roaming bands of thugs, essentially, I think. Maybe they call themselves Maoists, but I don't think they're really Maoists. The ideology behind the Maoists in the beginning was really all of these issues about caste discrimination and about women's issues. They do bring women into their group. They do bring Dalits into the group. I don't know how much authority they have. If they're just foot soldiers for the Maoists, I'm not exactly sure. It's difficult to know. But initially, I think, you know, their motives were in the right place, because it's gone on for over 10 years now, and 12 to 15,000 people have died over the past decade. People are very, very frustrated with everything. And I think people kept pouring out onto the streets was quite spectacular in Kathmandu. It's certainly something that I haven't seen in 2.5 years. For myself, in 2.5 years, there's a strike 1 week. You're not allowed to do anything. There's curfew, strike. This just goes back and forth. And I think people had really had enough of that. The political parties have taken a lot of credit for it, but I don't think that they deserve as much credit as they've actually gotten. I think it was very much a grassroots level sort of movement, and people were spilling in from outside of the Kathmandu Valley as well and taking part.
David, could you talk a little bit about the history of the Maoist presence in Nepal and what that was in response to?
In 1990, with the sort of reinstatement of democracy in Nepal, there was an initial period, a lot of hope initially, and the Maoists were, there is a communist party, there are two communist parties, one is actually in parliament, and then I think it was 95, 96, there was a disagreement within the communist party, and the Maoists are the ones who split from the one communist party that was in Nepal. And they were very frustrated with the corruption, with all of the development funds that have been pouring into the country and not reaching the countryside. So many projects from the huge bilaterals, Asian Development Bank or World Bank, all of these funds pouring in for projects, so much embezzlement, wasting of funds, corruption, etc. This was the sort of the initial spark, I think, in the countryside. In the first 5 years, what I know from talking to Nepalese there, that they had tremendous support. I think they still have tremendous support in some areas. They have a lot of presence and power outside of the Kathmandu Valley. In fact, they probably control every district center. The government will not admit that, but just in most of the programs I worked with were not in Kathmandu. They were in some of the very rural areas along the India border. I know for a fact that in those districts, that the Maoists controlled everything. If they said that this district office must close, then it would close. And I think the government knows that, or has known that. They have a lot of power. They have a lot of influence. Nepal's a very rural country. The access to areas is so difficult. Huge portions of the country, particularly in the west, in the mountainous areas, there are no roads. And even if the army or the security forces wanted to get into that area, they couldn't. In some particular areas, there are stories that they've been a bit more brutal than they have in other areas. But in the very, very remote parts of Nepal, I think that they're quite well accepted. They might see development professionals like myself who come in for a few days and talk about, you know, what are your needs? We're going to do this for you and this. But they never see any of the money. They never see any of the output of all of those projects. And with some of the Maoist groups, I think they did. Very, very small, in very small sort of ways, they were seeing the results. February of 2005 was when the king dissolved parliament, even though before that Parliament wasn't in session and hadn't been in session for quite a while. I think it was 2003. But he dissolved Parliament. He arrested the Prime Minister and all of the political party leaders. There was total censorship of the press. We had no electricity for a week. They cut communications both within Nepal and internationally. They closed down the airport, and tanks were on the streets for the first week. Things sort of calmed down after that. He kept political leaders under arrest, set up his own royal council, I believe he called it, with his own handpicked ministers, and sort of spoiled a lot of goodwill that had been happening with the Maoist. I think the Maoist and the government had been there. There were two ceasefires prior to that. They had had peace talks. It seemed as if things were moving again towards that. When the king came in February of 2005, all of that ended, and it became, a very aggressive policy. The king really has refused to budge with his policy, or lack of. And I think there's just a lot of frustration with that. When the king first came, he said, "Give me 3 years. I will solve this if you give me 3 years." And the king, you have to, whether you know or not, I mean, the king is regarded by many older Nepalese as a reincarnation of the god Vishnu. Not so much with the younger generation, I don't think, but still, it's. I mean, he's a very revered figure in Nepal. So I think with some people, they were frustrated and they felt like, well, let's give the king some opportunity to see if he can solve this crisis. But I think it was quite clear after 6 months or so that the king really wasn't trying to solve this crisis and was consolidating his own power. This king also, though, is not going back to his brother, Birendra, who was king before and was massacred, the whole royal family. There's not a lot of trust there with this king. In fact, if you talk to most Nepalese, they believe that the current king was somehow behind this, somehow was orchestrating this whole thing. So there's not a lot of love lost with this particular king. It's a very odd sort of situation where the king may be a god incarnate, and yet at the same time there's not a lot of trust in him. The build-up, I think, was most of the political party leaders had been released from house arrest. They were beginning to meet in secret. They had held talks not in Nepal, but in India, with some of the Maoist leaders. They agreed to this 12-point agreement that they would try to work together on the common agenda to overthrow the king. And it snowballed from that. And lots of people came out on the streets, and it didn't take long. I think the king was really backed into a corner. He had no support. He tried initially in the beginning to say, well, I'm going to hand power back to you, and I want you to recommend a prime minister to me, and then I will make the final decision. It was really great to see that Nepali said, no, that's not what we want. We're not going to let you decide anymore. No, we don't accept that. It only took another week or so before the king finally said, okay, I give up, and Parliament will be reinstated in 2 days.
What were the streets like at that time?
Most of the demonstrations in the beginning most of the rallies, demonstrations were taking place on what's called the Ring Road. It's a road around Kathmandu. Kathmandu is a small city by Asian standards, actually. About 2 million, which is very small in Asia. Initially, the security forces tried to confine it to this Ring Road, and they sort of let people come out. But as more and more incidents were happening, there were a lot of rubber bullets fired, a lot of people were injured. More and more of the international press were arriving in Nepal and documenting this. The BBC is always there, and they tend to have some of the better reports in Nepal. But more and more of the international press were coming and documenting this. People were moving a bit closer to the city center. The one event that really set off the rallies and demonstrations was one person was killed by security forces. The police, security forces, army took his body, and they cremated the body the next morning without informing the family. Cremation is a very important part of Hinduism and Hindu ritual, and the family must be there. They believe that, you know, if someone from the family is not there, that this person's spirit will not rest. This was documented by someone, I think Nepali Press. When the demonstrators heard about this, that was the day that they came very close to the palace. And in fact, most of the stories are now, if they really wanted to get to the palace, they could have. There was a lot of presence on the streets, but it was as if some of the larger crowds were looking for someone to kind of lead them in that direction, to say that, you know, we've made it this far, and yes, we can go to the palace. And the palace itself, it's this huge walled compound. No one knows what happens in there. These are just stories that I've heard. For myself, because I have a visa, I really wasn't allowed to go out, although I did go out some to sort of see if I could see things. From my rooftop, I could see fires in different parts of the cities, burning tires and things like that. And everything happened so quickly in the end that, in fact, the day that the king decided to reinstate parliament was the day before that the political parties had vowed 2 million people on the streets of Kathmandu, and we will march to the palace this day, and we will take control on this day. That was the day that the king decided to give in. It was wonderful. After so many years of this for Nepalis, frustrating for me for 2 years, but for Nepalis, this is going on for over a decade. Everyone was so happy. Everyone was on the street. Everyone wanted to join in the victory celebrations, and a lot of people did. There's still that euphoria. It's been a month now, or just over a month, and there's still a lot of that euphoria. The real challenge at the moment, if I'll sort of segue into this, is that these are the same political parties who've squandered so many opportunities in the past. These are the same political parties that are quite corrupt and not very accountable to the people. And I think that these are the sort of things that they haven't begun to address yet. At the same time, I think political parties are quite scared, and they've seen the power of the people. And I hope that that will instigate their move towards being more accountable and bringing in more diversity within the political parties. Since the demonstrations on the street, since parliament is being reinstated, every Dalit group, every indigenous peoples group, every women's group has been on the streets. And don't forget about us. We've been fighting for this for years now. I hope that the government will heed that message. They seem to be, so far, it's still early, but I will be like Nepalese and have a lot of hope for what's happening, because, I mean, it's tremendously positive at the moment. I mean, it's a real example of empowerment, because people talk about empowerment without action, and this idea of going in and doing these rights-based programs that we do. Oh, you know, we're empowering you to do this and this. But if there's not the next step, it's not empowerment at all. And this is a really great example of that. We take action. We had this positive result. Let's not stop now. The sky's the limit. I think this was one of the reasons why the king decided to give in, was that he didn't want to be exiled, or he didn't want to be killed. I think that he'll probably remain as a ceremonial figure. Although the parliament has made the decision, I'm not sure if this has been passed yet, but there was talk of this when I left, that the parliament will decide who the next king will be. It will no longer be the crown prince. It will no longer automatically be the son of the king. There are some things that have happened outside of, or since the people's movement in Nepal, that, for example, Nepal was a Hindu kingdom. It's been declared a secular state now. And all of the holy men, all of the sadhus, they've also taken to the streets, that this is part of our identity, to be Hindu. We are the only Hindu kingdom in the world. Why do we want to change that? Caste and religion, everything that's linked with it, it's difficult. I'm certainly no one to tell them that Hinduism is bad or good in this regard. I try to, as far as discrimination goes, look at it outside of a religious perspective, more from a humanitarian or secular approach. There will be a lot of growing pains, I think, for Nepal. So many things have happened. I mean, it's no longer His Majesty's government. It's no longer a Hindu kingdom. They'll have constituent elections soon. All of these things are quite new and profound. I mean, even Loktantra, it means is democracy in Nepali. Everybody, it's on everyone's lip. Loktantra, Loktantra this. Most people, if you ask them, what does it really mean? Most people don't really have a good idea of what it means. In the time that I've been in Nepal, I think people are they're more frustrated with the conflict itself, both from the Nepali security forces and the army and with the Maoists, because it tends to just go back and forth. There's an attack by one, and then there'll be a retaliation by the other.
Who's been arming the Nepali security forces?
The Americans, primarily. I think there are some funds that come from the British government as well, and there may be others, but I'm not sure. It's hard to know exactly what the funding is. The U.S. will always say that it's for training. I have a hard time believing that, but I don't have much proof. I tended to have a lot of contact with the Scandinavian countries, their equivalent of a USAID, their bilateral organization.
What exactly is a bilateral organization?
That's linked with a particular country's government. In the U.S., it's USAID. In the U.K., it's DFID, the Department for International Development. Most countries have them. Most of the funds for development, I think, are coming from the from Northern Europe, and also with the British. They have quite an influence in Nepal. Japan as well also puts in a lot of development aid in Nepal.
If you were planning on staying here for a while and doing organizing within the United States, mm-hmm. maybe what lessons, what tools would you impart to people wanting to make a change here?
It's interesting to me to see there's so many different grassroots, civil society types of organizations and groups doing so many different things. I think that's wonderful. But at the same time, perhaps things that are happening in this country are a bit too splintered. Mm-hmm. And maybe there does need to be more integration of both groups and of their mission and vision and what they're doing. I would never want to squelch any sort of movement and any new group that's forming and demanding their rights and taking to the street. But I think that would be my one sort of reaction. Thank you for asking me to come in and talk a little bit about it. I don't know that much, but maybe someone will hear this and someone will become interested in Nepal. And there are lots of other Nepals out there. I mean, Nepal is just one example, but it's important, and I think that people in the U.S. could certainly draw a lot of inspiration from this people's movement and taking to the streets.
Thanks to David Bloomer for sharing his experience in Nepal, and a special thanks to Jen Rawling. For more information about Nepal, check out nepalnews.com.
And now some community announcements. The Center for Intercultural Organizing has joined with Oregon Action and other community organizations to host a series of community listening sessions to give the police and the mayor a chance to hear firsthand experiences of community members around issues of racial profiling and other police issues. The next listening session is a special youth session and will take place Thursday, June 8th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Open Meadows Middle School, 7602 North Emerald in Portland.
June 9th through 11th is a weekend of resistance against the Green Scare. There will be events all over the world to educate those outside the eco community about the Green Scare and to raise funds to help those who are facing prison. In Eugene, on Sunday, June 11th, Derek Jensen and a representative from the Civil Liberties Defense Center will be speaking at Sam Bond's Garage. There will also be bands, including Resident Antihero. In Olympia, Washington, there will be a Reclaim the Streets parade and party June 9th at 4 p.m. at Heritage Park. On June 10th, there will be an educational forum about the Green Scare, the Patriot Act, and its legal impact to civil liberties. That will be at the Friendship Hall at the Olympia YWCA. For more information, there is a page about the Green Scare on Portland Indie Media.
Circle A Radio airs every first and third Wednesday of the month here on KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio. We would love to hear from you. If you have any show ideas or feedback for us, contact us at info@circlearadio.org. Good night.
That was India Blue by Ali Abkar Khan from the album Music That Speaks to the Spirit.